What note is this, Blewett?
Man.
And welcome. To the Down in Front Podcast, the official podcast of downinfrontpodcast.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for joining. Yes, you hear that right. It's your boy, and I'm back. I don't know for how long, but we're going to be hanging out. I'm thoroughly appreciative of everybody who made it through the pandemic. Yes, we're still in it. Let's not get that shit twisted, but it's still going to be crazy, and we're still going to be here for you. So we are super excited. We have the whole new crew here. We're going to go around the room a little bit. If this is first episode, I want to say thank you so much, and we appreciate you being here. Tonight, we're going to be reviewing on Netflix, Things Heard and Seen, starring Amanda Seyfried, the guy from that Wes Anderson movie, the other dude that's from Little Women, and the person I think that's from Better Call Saul. So I don't remember a lot of people's names, but I think I'm pretty accurate on that. But before we get into that review, we're going to kind of talk about what else we've been watching, what we're currently sipping on, because that is our thing, although we're getting a lot older, but you know, who knows? Give you a little bit of a spoiler sort of break before we get into our particular sort of topic. So as always, I'm going to pass it over to my best friend. We grew up in Memphis together. We enjoy long walks and barbecue. Brylan, what's going on, man? What you sipping on tonight? What else you got going with you?
Hey, what's going on? Great to hear you're hosting again. I know my sexy voice can always make hosting do really well, but Warren, you got a sexy voice too. So why not?
But why though?
Shut up, Blood.
But yeah, like what I've been doing recently, what I've been sipping on, what I've been watching. I recently turned the ripe young age of 42 over the weekend, so it was my birthday.
There we go.
Which was awesome. And we're recording this 2 days after my birthday, so that's the only reason this day is known for, is just 2 days after my birthday, nothing else. But what I've been sipping on is I still got my bottle of Terramana tequila, so I made another little tequila screwdriver. Tastes great. I love this stuff. And what I've been watching recently is I checked out the new special that dropped on Apple TV Plus for Mythic Quest right before they released season 2 of Mythic Quest. And they did release a special early in the pandemic where they were basically all on a Zoom call and talking about the chaos of trying to build a video game while in a pandemic scenario, and it was actually very creative and really cool what they did with that episode. This episode is them going back to the office for the first time after post-pandemic, and them having a little role play celebration for what's considered the biggest holiday in their video game, and it was hilarious. And someone we'll see in the movie that we're reviewing tonight, F. Murray Abraham, he continues to kill it as the old guy that just sticks out like a sore thumb, but he's the writer, so he's just coming up with the craziest ideas ever, so he's always awesome. But I really love that cast. I can't wait to see what they do for season 2, and this was like a nice little, like kind of a tapas before you get into the whole meal that's coming for season 2 of Mythic Quest. So I enjoyed it. I really like that Apple TV Plus, if they do one thing right, are these comedies with hearts of gold and earnestness in them. So I would say, aside from Ted Lasso, Mythic Quest is probably the next best thing that's on Apple TV Plus.
Quick question. Is a tapas and an appetizer the same thing?
No.
Tapas is actually a main course.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shared food.
Yeah, tapas are a bunch of small things that you eat for your main course.
It's like wicked expensive, but it's so worth it like once every 3 years.
I was thinking of palate cleanser, but I was listening to a podcast where they broke everything down as a tapas meal. So it, I got confused.
It's all good.
No, I wasn't like trying to out anybody. I just didn't know. So I didn't want to be a culture swine.
You would totally start trying to out someone.
Blew it.
Well, you got some beef with me, bro? Because we can throw hands.
I thought you were vegetarian.
No, that was also like 6 years ago when I was.
That was a 303 reference, and I feel really proud of that one because that is a hilarious line, and then the whole rest of the song sucks.
Yeah, it's 303. Is that a?
They were that. Wait, they were that. No, that's a different synthesizer. 303 TB. It's a baseline.
Anyways, Brian, really what else have you? What else? What else have you been watching? Shut up, Blewett.
I've not been hitting the drum pads. That's for sure. But I've also been watching little animes here and there, and I watched all of Pacific Rim: The Black, which is it's the first season because they've been renewed for a second season already. And for the most part, I enjoyed it. It brought the things I love about Pacific Rim, which are giant robots punching kaiju. And the rest of it is more like your standard anime that you would get in this like post-apocalyptic world. So not much that they're changing the game on this. It definitely doesn't have the corniness or the silliness that people like Charlie Day and Bern Gorman brought to the movies. But I still enjoy the whole idea behind Pacific Rim and the world building that they're doing here. And the whole idea of a black zone is really interesting too, and why it's a black zone as well. I thought it was actually I think it was a really cool start off. I'm curious to see where they'll take it next because they are doing a little twist on kaiju and Jaegers and even what the neural handshake does as well.
Pacific Rim: The Black, in my opinion, did an infinitely better job at embodying the spirit of the original Pacific Rim and Guillermo del Toro's vision and continuing on that story than Pacific Rim 2 ever did.
Oh, yeah.
Pacific Rim 2, like this movie almost like kind of like overwrites Pacific Rim 2 in terms of the content, I feel like. But I thought it was way better than I expected it to be. I expected it to be bad. And it was also better for me the second time through. I watched it twice. The first time I had some expectations that it didn't meet, but once I got over that and saw what they were doing with the story, I actually really liked it.
That's good to hear, because I, as a person who should have loved Pacific Rim, I mean, fucking robots and monsters, like, I feel like that the first movie like really shit the bed for me, and I was really sad, and then number two was just even worse. So I hope if you're telling me, because something that's anime, which is my wheelhouse, is somewhat sort of corrects a little bit. Like, I like some of the things they did in number one, but not a whole lot. I think I'll be curious to sort of check it out.
Yeah. And other than that, the only other thing I was watching is Mac Jones. Yeah. Let's go, Pats.
That's some old like show from the 70s?
No, but whenever I see Mac Jones's name, I want to say it like Mike Jones. I want to go, Mac Jones.
He's trash, bro. Just like the other quarterback he drafted.
I don't know. He's got a beer gut. So that gives me hope that he will be a 10-time Super Bowl champion.
He's trash, just like the whole team. Rylan, it's great to see your face. It's great to have you on the podcast that you've been hosting.
Awesome. Thank you.
I'm going to toss it on over to my other best friend, not the guy who's going to catch these cold hands tonight. Mocha, what's going on, man? What you sipping on tonight, and what else you got going on with you?
What is up, everybody? So glad to see all of your lovely faces. What am I sipping on? Water. Just keeping it, trying to keep things going with not getting drunk or consuming alcohol on days where I'm not trying to get drunk from consuming alcohol. So yeah, just a little fresh water. I also just came back from a run, so water is kind of the default at that point. What I've been watching, a bunch of stuff, but I did spend some time this weekend watching The Mitchells versus The Machines. And Warren, I know you have plenty of thoughts about that, but man, this movie, I really liked it. Sony Animation is just on a roll, and they are absolutely killing it with the creativity and the variant art styles that they're meshing for their new movies. There was like a really strong sense of chaos, like chaotic comedy to this movie that I wasn't expecting, and I don't know if I was ready for because it took me off guard. But once I like settled into it, I really enjoyed it. It was full of heart. has some really great character relationships and really legitimately made me laugh a couple of times. So yeah, definitely check it out if you have the time. It's on Netflix and it's 100% worth your watch.
Fucking loved this movie. If anybody has seen the Lego movie, almost any of them, but mainly like Lego Movie 1 or 2, I think you're definitely going to like this. I felt like this movie was made literally for Warren Jackson, who has ADHD. So you just mix Warren Jackson sort of Emma and make this like strange, amazing person. Because I sat there was like, this is everything I wanted in the movie. And I was like cackling. I was laughing. I was sad. I was like, this has everything wrapped up. It also had like some weird vibes of sort of Super Jail in one hand, then it had vibes of Adventure Time in the other hand. I was like, they rolled it all up into one, but also made it somewhat meme heavy. I'll leave it at that. Fuck, I really enjoyed this movie, and I laughed so hard at a lot of points.
Yeah, it really meshed the like chaotic comedy of the Lego movie with the artistic like freedom and creativity of Spider-Man, Spider-Verse, excuse me, into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, the animation and art is fucking stunning in this film.
Yeah, and very different from Into the Spider-Verse, but still that sort of same mix and layering of different types of art styles that somehow works despite them being very, very distinct in the way they're being used. I think there was something really special with the team who worked on this, and it should not go unwatched by people. Definitely, especially since it's on Netflix. Netflix and Sony have written out a deal where Sony Animation is going to be releasing all of their animated films directly to Netflix in the coming year, I think. So yeah, take advantage of that, because this was definitely like, it would have been a blockbuster theater film if they had released in theaters.
Well, Mocha, is always great to have you on. It's great to see your face.
Great to be here.
Oh, it's blew it. God. What's going on, man? What you been sipping on tonight? What else you got going for you?
No one even cares. That's a lie. That was way too depressing. It's almost summer.
Okay. All right, Eeyore, relax.
It's almost summer. This is the summer of the boys. I don't even know what that means. So
I think we have boys of summer.
Yeah, never see that again.
No, yeah. It's summer of the boys. Summer of the boys. Cool. So I'm sipping on a little something, which might be dangerous because throwback to Ant-Man. This was, I believe, the beer of choice for that night. And it's a good one. It's a very good beer, although this is a way cooler environment than Jesse Rand's apartment circa 2014.
Oh my God. First of all, that was Blewett's first episode?
Yep, first episode.
That recording sucked so badly. We were cramped up, and he didn't have like his AC something or broke. Nope.
It was 4,000 degrees in that apartment. Yeah, no, it's great.
This is what we do for our audience. We sacrifice.
No, we not anymore. We're in air conditioned places right now, but yeah, in the early years we were definitely suffering for the art. And I'm also stalling because as according to tradition, it almost seems like I watch stuff when Warren isn't on the podcast. I pretty much didn't watch anything. The only things that I really did was watch the NFL draft, which was fun. I do think the Patriots, as opposed to this hater over here, I think the Patriots made some pretty good picks. I'm excited to see the season. I'm also just excited because the season should be slightly closer to normal. And so it'd be cool to, I don't know. I'm just excited to see the world again.
People in the stadiums, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Except for the Florida teams. I mean, they had people in the stadium every single day. There wasn't even a game. They're just like, 40,000 people, let's go.
not Jacksonville. Nobody went to those games. Come on.
I was trying to think. I'm like, no one cares about the Dolphins. No one cares about the Jaguars. The Bucks, they only cared because they have a pirate ship and Tom Brady. Like, yeah, whatever. Also, I did start finally The Witcher 3's the last DLC. So 6 years later, I'm finally bearing down on the last 50 hours of this game. So I'm pretty excited about that. And I think next up, I'll let you two weigh in. Mocha, I really don't care about your opinion. Death Stranding or Last of Us 2. That's going to be my spring game. Which one should I play?
Are you in the mood for something that's very depressing?
I think both of them are very depressing. I've played the first 2 hours of both games.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't played Death Stranding, but it seems less depressing than Last of Us 2.
The first mission, and this is no spoiler alert, because it's the first mission, you carry your dead mom to her gravesite up a mountain.
Okay, so, that's some sadness.
Yeah, so...
It is a spoiler because it's the first mission.
I know, but it's literally the first 10 minutes of the game. So, and I don't know much beyond that because it was very tough. But both games have a spring-like atmosphere. They both have like this hazy spring rain type thing that apparently we should be getting now, but like, I don't know, global warming. So, you know, it's not, but, I like to pair my video games with the weather. Yeah. And so both, I think I can do one this year and then one next year, but
I would say trial Death Stranding.
All right.
Just because you kind of make up your own story.
All right.
And to a point in that.
Audience, write us in at
the crew at downinfrontpodcast.com. Yes.
Oh, there's no way he's gonna remember that right now.
No. I was gonna say it was jesseransring@ymail.com.
That'd be good. Yes. Well, it's always great to have you on. It's great to see your face.
Thank you.
I am Warren. I will be your host this evening. I am currently sipping on some water also, like mocha, and a little vodka soda, High Noon, black cherry. So I'm going to be drinking those two tonight. What I've been watching, I also have been trying to finally watch a bunch of stuff. Semester break in between summer and spring. So I finally can binge a lot of shit. And I have been. That was great. Only a couple things I want to talk about. Yasuke, watched that. I think it's either 6 or 8 episodes, I can't remember. On Netflix, really enjoyed it. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about it a little bit later. So I think everybody would probably sort of dig the show. The animation of this show is absolutely phenomenal. Like, I'm really, really enjoying it and digging not only the animation, but the music, but it just feels like everybody is sort of upping their game, which is beautiful. Just to see a lot of the different types of sort of animation in these different departments. So hopefully something like Leica, they're not doing stop motion, but I'm following Leica's, you know, work. Anything they come out with, I'm going to inhale it and watch it. So similar things, I want to try to do that for more of the animation companies and departments, because you usually never really hear from them. Then the other thing I've been checking out.
Was it MAPPA? They did the animation for Korra.
Oh, did they? Oh, okay. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah, nice. Other thing I watched on Amazon Prime is Invincible. I believe somebody put it on our sort of poll, and I sort of checked it out. I think they just had their season finale. Episode 1 is nuts. I had some thoughts about the rest of it. I still have some thoughts on the entire show, but I think it's worth giving a shot. Although, from what everybody's sort of talking about, they're like, you might as well just sort of read it. So I don't know if I want to kind of read it now, just to see if it's better or worse. So I'll keep it sort of spoiler free. Somebody put a note in, no spoilers that they're talking about there. But I think it's at least worth a watch. The voice acting and sort of the animation alone is pretty damn good. In both of those, when we sort of talking about some of the characterizations and what they're trying to do, and bringing something a little bit newer to a superhero film, superhero TV animated TV show. So I think that's actually pretty interesting. There's a lot of stuff that I've never seen before that they've done in the actual show that I'm like, oh, okay. I may not agree with some things, but this is pretty cool and it's new. So I'm giving them, you know, some props there. So that's it, what we're watching here. What we're going to do, we're going to take a quick break, because after, when we come back, we're going to go into our full spoiler section of... I want to call this the things they carry, but it's not, that's a whole book different. Things heard and seen. So we'll be right back after a quick break. And we are back, and we're the Down in Front Podcast in a spoiler section of Things Heard and Seen. I'll apologize. I'm going to forget the title of this movie every time we mention it, so hopefully I can try to remember it. Anywho, we are in our spoiler section, so we're normally going to be breaking this up into a couple of different sort of areas. We're going to talk about our overall thoughts, kind of feelings of the actual movie itself, go into our MVPs before we kind of go and close out the show with our conclusion. So I'm going to go and toss it and have Brylin sort of kick us off and give me your overall thoughts on Things Heard and Seen on Netflix.
Yeah, this movie I was calling Things Seen and Heard for the longest time today. But I did not like this movie at all. I thought it was a pretty bad movie. I think like the big problem that this movie has with it is just the premise it sets up. We get a mix of the haunted house horror movie plus the troubled spouse suspense thriller that we've seen be very trendy recently, especially with like The Haunting of Bly Manor, The Haunting of Hill House, but also with things like Gone Girl or the Girl on the Train movies that have come out recently. And they try to blend them together, and I think it actually makes for a worse movie than can be expected. For one, I think the dialogue is absolutely terrible. I've never been to the Hudson River Valley, so I don't know if this is normal behavior, if it's normal for a professor to just say, hey, come to our local seance, it's going to be cool. To me, that's just first sign of that you need to get the hell out of there, because someone like your professor, your boss asking you, hey, come to our seance tonight, it'll be fun. That's just a one-way trip down to a weird place already. But there is some dialogue in here that I found pretty bad. There's a rainy moment where we have Amanda Seyfried and the actor who I would actually refer to, poor man's Richard Madden, who was absolutely terrible.
I was going to say poor man's guy from Insidious.
That's a very, very poor man's version of that.
I thought he was great for it in this role. We'll talk about it later.
He's fine. He just looked like a poor man's. Yes. What's that dude's name? Orem from Aquaman.
Patrick Wilson.
Yeah,
Patrick
Wilson. He just looked like a.
I said Richard Madden. He had a Richard Madden hair going.
Richard Madden is a stretch.
He's not right? Anything like Richard Madden.
I guess that's a stretch. I'm being generous there. Like.
Brian, I know you're doing this to trigger me. And it's working.
He looks like typical white person.
Yes, that's correct. You are accurate there.
Wow.
And they're arguing, and I understand, like, yeah, her bulimia is an issue, and his infidelities are an issue, which are you can already tell is going to lead down a slippery slope. But the way they're arguing with one another, I found very, very comical. It must have been the way it was portrayed or the way it was just set up. But that whole scene where they just get out of the car and start arguing, I thought was utterly ridiculous.
Do you want to know what? I had a major issue with that scene as well. And it was also to do with the talking. Does everyone here know what ADR is? Automatic dialogue replacement. So basically what happens is that you record stuff on a set. Sets are oftentimes loud, especially if they're outdoors. So a lot of cases you can't use that audio and you have to replace it. This is very evident if you ever watch someone from behind the shoulder. The camera is looking over their shoulder to the other person that the person's speaking to. Look at their chin. People speak with their chin, subtle up and down bobs. That will never line up because oftentimes they'll just replace the dialogue over there to make it fit. And the benefit of this is you could do it at whatever point. So as long as you have the script, you could shoot it like a week before the premiere and just edit in the line and it will fit perfectly. You can also do ADR facing a character. And that's fine. You just have to make sure that the person saying the same words, you say it with the same tone of voice, and then do a little bit of effect processing to make it fit like the scene. That scene, they failed miserably on it.
Yeah. There that was must one, have been why it threw me off.
There was one point when she was very clearly mouthing stuff, but it was not what she was saying. And I've never seen that in a movie that was like more than just a student project, right? Like, it was a garbage set. It was fall, like, in New England-ish, kind of, outdoors. Like, I can imagine that audio is garbage. Replace it. That's fine. Just do it from behind the shoulder, like everyone else does, so you can't tell that the actress is not saying a single word of what she is saying. It was wild. Yeah, it blew my mind.
Yeah, it was bad. And the other moment that, like, just kind of, I found a lot of things cringy just because of, I mean, maybe just these white people were just weird to me.
Okay, Pocahontas is dad.
But white people are there's dangerous. A librarian that she says, you know, that's not a non-gendered name. I'm like, come on. I was like, the name Willis, like, anything can be non-gendered when it comes to a name. There's nothing that's making a name exclusively gendered.
Oh, that was just about her wanting that was just about her wanting to be like a gossip, though. That wasn't about
that was like a little like she's the one to be like, yeah, your man's like stepping out on you, and if you don't realize that, yeah, you might as well.
I hear you, like, on this. There's
such a cringy way of actually bringing that up. It was so horrible.
Going back to sort of Blewett's point here, a lot of stuff in this movie made it seem like it was a student-made film, and it's almost as like, I understand this movie is supposed to take place in the 80s.
Yeah.
Was this movie written and created in the 80s? Because there's a lot of shit that's just in this film that it's just like so head-scratching, stupid, and illogical, right? Like, the characters in this film, and going to that point here, Brylan, the characters in this film are just so dumb that it's just like weird, right? And it's almost, it was just so lazy that, okay, somehow we have to figure out to tell Catherine that George is seeing somebody or maybe sleeping with somebody. So how do we do that?
Willis.
Right. So how do we do that? They decided on to talk about her name as the way to do it without actually having Franny, the little daughter who met her, bring it up naturally in another different way. Right. I find that moment, I'm like, yeah, cringy is so spot on, because I'm like, oh man.
Not to cringe even harder, but like, what are you talking about, Willis, to that librarian? Because, dude, her husband teaches at a college. Like, it's not like this is like middle school, where that would be very weird if like people shared books. Like, it's college. Like, it's not, I feel like it's not that crazy to be like, she's like a 22-year-old college student. Like, maybe her husband gave her a ride to the library. Like, that's not weird at all. And
that's a little weird. It's not like grounds for divorce, but it's a little weird.
If I found out that my
teacher or husband was like giving rides to like the 18-year-old co-eds, I'd be like, for what? She's a horse girl.
But she could have like easily checked out the book and said, hey, I think you should read this. Like, there's stuff here that could have been easily done in an effective way.
It would have been weird if it was like a math book. It's like, oh yeah, my husband is an absolute idiot with math. Like, why does he have a math book from some college girl in there? But it's like an art book, and he is like an artist. So it made no sense whatsoever.
What they should have done was had there pull out the card, or go to pull out the card, but instead of a card, it's a used condom. And then she's like, oh, well, Willis isn't a gendered name. Like, throws it over her shoulder.
That's daddy's friend. Yes, Franny. That's perfect. Perfect line.
Great. Sorry, Brian, there's a lot of cleverness that they were trying to put in this movie, and I think it fails on a lot of it. But one thing I did think that was actually pretty neat, but they didn't really pursue it that much, was the illusion that, is it, what's poor man Richard Madden's name? George in this movie?
George, yeah.
Okay. That George kind of stole his cousin's identity, that those paintings are not his, that his cousin was gay and actually ostracized from society and kills himself. And so he kind of found a way to kind of make himself look good, unless George has always been murdering.
I thought this was kind of
just it's that side dish when It's like, you could use that as the main course and make a really cool movie out of it.
So the movie isn't 100% terrible, because you can see some things that they clearly could have done in the film to make it good. And even when we start off the movie, we don't know anything about these characters, but it's quickly assumed that Catherine's character, played by Amanda Seyfried, is going to be the main character. It's like, okay, cool. So then we learn about something about the dissertation. And it's like they're sprinkling things in different areas to wait for some payoff that was like, oh, cool. But it just missed on everything. And I was like, damn, you have this in the film. We as the audience is waiting to say like, oh, okay, he killed him. And he sort of somewhat took his identity. That would have been way more entertaining than whatever it is he tried to do. So I'm somewhat baffled. I don't want to read this the book, but I'm somewhat baffled by the execution of certain things, because it was there. And that's why I said it looked like it was written from like forever ago. Because this is a very, very, very old sort of, shtick's not the right word, but plot, I guess, that we've seen a lot of times sort of happen, especially when you're talking about some sort of domestic abuse and abusive relationships. Like, we have seen this many, 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 many times. So why are you trying to somewhat do something different when we sort of know what is kind of happening, and we as the audience is somewhat believing in this supernatural or real space that you're sort of crafting for us? You then just take a bunch of weird left turns that's like, this doesn't make any sense.
So
why did
Warren,
you choose to do that way?
Yeah, completely, completely agree. It's like they somehow cast Amanda Seyfried and they're like, well, she's the biggest name in the film, so let's make her the lead. So
she gets most of the paycheck.
Horror films, we've talked about this plenty of times in the past, and specifically, I'm referring to Jordan Peele's movies, right? Where he uses, you can most easily see this, let me say, all these good horror films all have this subtext, where they take your main character's weakness and make the horror around them tie into that. So racism in America with both, you know, like with Get Out, right? Like that's a horror in real life that the... oh my God, I forget his name. It's been too long. Daniel Kaluuya's character. Like,
I mean,
you know,
Oscar winner Daniel Kaluuya.
No, I know. But like, you also tie that in with the horror, and it just tells a better story. So what was Amanda Seyfried's biggest character plot, or like biggest negative about her?
Well,
the bulimia and the drinking, right?
Yeah.
Well,
and drink her protein shake.
Possibly. Well, it was that.
Yeah, but how did that tie into the supernatural? Because I could see there was a way more, like you said, Warren, there was a way more intriguing story of if we followed around George and had him as a liar the whole time, and you slowly chipped away and saw those lies, it's way more believable that an evil spirit is tying into those negative behaviors versus, you know, like the eating disorder, like what caused the eating disorder? It has nothing to do with the supernatural. So those plot points are completely devolved from each other. Why do we care about them? Right? Like there's a good spirit that does nothing evil the entire time. Also this bulimia thing, but they don't tie into the main conflict of the film. Whereas George, like you could have just slowly peeled away the onion and showed him to be more and more crazy as the supernatural stuff increases and as the evil presence like impacts his life. That's a way cooler experience. And then,
this is what I thought they would do that. Like, I think they were actively trying to do exactly what you said, Blewett, but they somehow chose a weird different path.
Because Amanda Seyfried is a name.
Right. Well, and here's the thing that's really odd, right? I was getting some weird Marriage Story vibes from here, too, of the woman, the main character in this particular movie, is somewhat trapped in a weirdly abusive, in this case, literal, like super physical and mentally abusive relationship. And so I kind of go back to like some of the opening dialogue of this movie when her friend's asking her, oh, you're just going to leave your job for all that? Like, she had a high pay. Like, there was a lot of stuff that, you know, Catherine's character had, a lot. And we didn't really, like, it was weird that the movie showed us the bulimia super, super early on. I want to say the first scene, like the first 3 minutes. And I'm like, oh, okay, that sucks. There's a lot of things that could cause that. Like, that's not something that I'm no expert, clearly, but that's not something that women and people who have that sort of condition is just naturally born with. There's clearly some external or some other factor that's somehow triggering or causing this. In this film, they just said, oh yeah, this is something that she just does and has.
Yeah.
And it had nothing to do with the husband, who was the issue here of the abusive relationship, which should have a focus on there. Or, like you said, Blewett, like, talk about, does he have an evil spirit? Has he always had an evil spirit since he killed his cousin? Right? Like,
yeah.
And he stole it, and he forged this. It's just weird.
So, and I think they allude to this early when they move to the Hudson River Valley, is like their neighbors and everything are telling them, like, oh yeah, all these houses are old and they'll be here way past us too. So it's normal to, like, you're going to get a house that had a dead person in it one time. So, like, having a dead person in your house is not out of the norm in this area. And I just think they don't do a really good job of telegraphing, like, that idea towards the establishing, like, the setup of the movie.
So that was a really cool idea. And I kind of want to come back to this because I think there's a lot to unpack there. Just one last thing on the main character focus. I loved the one line of when George was standing butt naked and he goes, if you're really there, show me a sign. And then it quick cuts to the upper bedroom and the crow fly or raven flies through the window. I thought that was awesome. That was a really well done scene. Imagine if that was the buildup, and then you get the scene, and then he goes downstairs, he sits in the car, again, tying into the old people that had been in the house previously, and then you get a very dramatic shot of him walking to the barn or wherever, getting the axe, and then again, following him up the entire flight of stairs. And you just get this build of, like, hey, this person is just crazy. And they might have voices in their head. They might be just a lying psychopath, right? I think I got, American Psycho vibes all the time, you know, for the back half of that movie from him. And then all of a sudden he just stares at his wife for a while and then chops into her with an axe. Like, that should have been a major drawn out scene. And there was no build up to it whatsoever. There was the one really cool line. He was sitting mumbling to himself in a car for a couple minutes. And then he walks upstairs. I don't know. That was such a miss thing. But sorry, Brylan. You're absolutely right. Like, I think they had an interesting lore there of not quite like witches, like the Salem witch trial, but it was like a very real thing of, like, yes, any place on the planet where there's a house that has been there for generations, there has been dead people in it. And that's a very real thing that's pretty much, 90% of the world's population probably can say that they lived in a house that is old enough that could have had a dead person in it, you know? So that's an interesting thing to dive into of, like, what rural lifestyles entail and how rural people might deal with death different than a city person might deal with death. And then it just was completely unpacked. Unpacked? Yeah, ununpacked.
Yeah, and just to show how bad the editing is to where everything lacks an impact, like the weird butt scene, at first I thought that was poor man's Billy from Stranger Things, aka Eddie, after he had sex with Amanda Seyfried, just standing there naked, said he got sick on his clothes at first, because I just didn't put two and two together that was George, like, putting his wet clothes in the washing machine, until I saw that was George walking up the stairs. I thought, like, oh yeah, this guy just had sex with Amanda Seyfried. Probably was his first time, and he's puking because he's nervous. That's where my mind went when I saw that scene.
Well, kind of going back to this one line you talked about, Brylan, from what I thought they were trying to do is the line they're somewhat talking about, the houses as though the houses are going to outlive us, and we're in this weird sort of country. I don't know where Hudson River Valley is. Technically upstate, but I don't know how close it is to where I'm from. Upstate.
Somewhere in New York.
Yeah, I know. I don't know where from where I'm from in upstate, but probably somewhere close to where my father and his family's from. Anyway, so from what I was somewhat trying to somehow got was, oh, okay, so there's more than just the mortal world that they're considering, right? And that made a little bit more sense of the seances, the ghosts, the additional spirits. And even when we were talking about the friend, I can't remember her name, but the weaving and the cosmic, like all of this made it seem like, oh, okay, these people are a little, you know, different because they do believe that there's a world outside of this mortal world that we're in. And they, if a ghost were to pop up, they're not going to freak the fuck out. And that was really, really effective when Floyd, the teacher, I believe his name was Floyd, walks up the steps and immediately was like, acknowledges the fact that, oh, you have somebody else's here. And validated, and this is some good acting, and this is a really good acting piece, like 3 minutes here, of validating her entire existence of the movie and how she's not crazy and how there's a ghost here. And he says, yes, that's somewhat normal. This is what we do. These spirits will always be here. So I love that little bit of it because, oh, okay, but we kind of need a little bit more here. And especially because at this point, we already had some weird jump scares of the ghosts that made it seem malevolent, right? And I was like, okay, well, is that really what it is? Or we're just not sure. So especially because if the good ghost was exploding light bulbs and like brightening the light bulbs so bright so that Franny couldn't sleep and scare her. So like, it's a little weird. I find that sort of somewhat strange, right? Like we have these small moments of like, oh, cool. Like that's really helpful that there are some characters that are just like, oh, cool. There's spirits in here. And I felt that's what the line was trying to do, but nobody else even seemed to give a shit besides that one little group of four or five people.
I did like the effectiveness of having them all being like older. And I thought that was an interesting thing, the dichotomy of like young folks, you know, younger, right? Like they were both in their mid-30s, being kind of afraid of the afterlife, whereas like the older folks were like, yeah, it's just natural, you know, like it comes and goes. One thing that I did actually really like and would have liked to have seen this done more was the intersection of art and life and death. Did everyone else notice besides the last scene that like most of the paintings in the film were like of the characters?
They go back always to this artist that I didn't know of. What was his name? Swedenborg.
I didn't look him up to see if he's actually real or not. No. So this is even besides him. If you look at some of the paintings in the background, they were all of the characters in the film. Like literally one time there was what's his face, like came into a room one, and there was a picture right next to him that was doing the exact same like face. So I thought it was a really cool, like I thought it was an interesting plot point with a like, oh yeah, an art professor or sorry, excuse me, an ex-artist and artist wife. And then the art is kind of like mirroring their lives. Like the picture hanging up on the stairwell looked like Natalie Dyer's character, like straight up. So she was in the house even before she was in the house messing with their marriage, you know? I thought that was really cool. And it kind of tied in with the aesthetic of like the old art professors and the old English teachers, like not, you know, it's like having that bridge to the app. I thought that was a very interesting point, and it just kind of was like underdeveloped. Also, they completely messed it up with the end being like the corniest ending, where like at that point the reference was so ham-fisted that like, get it, it's a painting that like instead of going to heaven in the soul, it's like he goes to hell. Oh no. So it's like the payoff in it was so garbage, but it was a really cool thing incorporating, like Warren said, that group of folks that was like very into art and into like the art movement of like bridging the line between living and the dead. Like that was awesome until the very end when it very much wasn't.
Well, and I'm appreciative of the movie to try and do something like trying to change our perception of not only heaven and hell, but like this world and the next and the other worlds and sort of passing over. And specifically when they sort of mentioned this, Emanuel Swedenborg, who's a real person, by the way.
Nice.
They also necessarily talked about, you know, death is the beginning, right? And I was somewhat happy or like, oh, okay, so it's life. It's not just life or death here. They're talking about something larger here, especially when you're talking about the souls. And although the physical body leaves, the soul still remains on this, you know, in this particular kind of realm to help and guide. So I'm like, okay, so they're trying to do something a little bit more. I get that. I'm sort of understanding. You mentioned the ending, and I think we'll talk about that a little bit later. That shit didn't make any sense to me from even what they were mentioning. But there was something weird about, like, okay, some of the stuff in the film just didn't seem to line up when they're talking about this other world and the other spirits, especially because we have the spirit of Ella, which was the two boys' mother, who was killed by asphyxiation from her husband who lived in it. So that's how, you know, my parents died in a car accident. Ah, okay. So I see how they ended up really dying in this house.
I thought the ghost they saw was the original wife of the homeowner or of the guy that built the house.
No, because...
Okay, so that was Eddie and Cole's mom.
Yeah, but the ring has been passed through. Mm-hmm. So here's the other thing that doesn't quite make any sense, right? Why isn't the original... So it definitely seems as though the original spirit or the original person in the painting was also killed by her husband. So then her soul goes on to try to protect the next one who was also killed by her husband. And then now Ella, who's there, is trying to protect Catherine, who's also killed by her husband. So now I'm like... You're not really doing a good job, spirits, if these people are dying, or unless the goal here is to allow people to die, to allow them to really live out their you know, life starts at death. But that's also weird because now we're like, well, Franny is an orphan. What about the little girl who's like left on this planet, which is a little weird. Like I find it really strange that some of the things they talk about in the film, and I was like, okay, well, how does that actually work? If people were to die, I felt like no one gave a shit about the little girl daughter. near the end of it, it's like no one cares about this little girl, which really sucks because she's now probably going to witness a hell of a lot of violence. And I find that really weird that they just sort of throw away that character entirely for trying to bring up that, well, physical bodies and beings doesn't matter. It really matters about what your spirit and how that sort of addresses, especially when we have a random character who's in a coma.
Yeah, but the thing about the little girl, which is, I think, a frustrating thing about this whole movie in general, is that the little girl didn't matter. The only reason that she was there from a narrative perspective was to give Amanda Seyfried a reason to have entered into this marriage with someone who she was already on the rocks with. Mm-hmm. And it ties into one of the most frustrating things about this movie for me in general is that, and we touched on it already in the conversation, but it's a masterclass in why Chekhov's gun is a consistent like methodology in story writing. Because there are so many things that appear in this movie that should be able to be involved in some form of payoff, and none of it ever, like very little of it ever does. The interactions with the ghosts never really matters, like never really pays off. The child, her interactions with the ghosts and just her being present never really matters. The piano, like that, we get that whole scene where she's like, why would somebody leave a piano here? And it's not like the piano's filled with ghosts or there's a dead body in there. It's just a piano. It doesn't matter at all. Like so many things that they go out of their way to point out don't matter. It was very, very frustrating for me watching this movie when we got to the end and the end just stops because I was like, there's so, like, nothing was tied together by the end of it. It was just a whole bunch of strings laid on the ground. And then they were like, oh, but check out this cool artsy way we could end it.
Yeah. Also, why did they start the movie with him noticing the blood splatter on the glass? I felt that was weird.
It was just to throw off the audience, so that way they didn't think that he was the one who kills her. But it was pointless, again. Like,
yeah. It's the same type of bait and switch that they've done in Gone Girl and a lot of movies like that recently.
Oh, I don't know about that one. Like, it's just weird that they started off like that. It's like, this is odd. And then we clearly come up, and it's not like an aha moment. Like, we know at this point, we already knew, at the audience knew 15, 20 minutes before that scene comes back around. It's like, well, this is not helping anybody. Anywho.
Yeah, that was another frustrating thing about the buildup in the movie was that as soon as it opened with blood dripping down, the husband walking in, grabbing the daughter, and then running away, I knew then for the rest of the movie that no matter what stressful thing happened, the daughter and the husband were fine, right? So I kept waiting for moments where these other neighborly characters that they kept introducing would fall victim to the ghosts or be like killed in some sort of way that was like sudden and surprising. And none of that ever happens. So the movie really lost its edge from the thrill standpoint of it, outside of just a few jump scares here and there. But again, like even the jump scares didn't really matter much because I knew that the only thing that could happen was that something might happen to the wife during the daytime. So like all those nighttime ghost scenes didn't matter. Like, I don't know. Yeah, it was frustrating.
Brian, what else you got?
I mean, other things that I found, I think Amanda Seyfried was kind of wasted here. She's a great actress, but she doesn't really get much to work with, even though I think she, for the most part, does the best job. I do like Justine's character to a point. She kind of makes this world make sense in a bit, where she is saying, like, hey, I'm part of this, like, I go into this cosmic realm when I'm weaving and stuff, and kind of you get this weird scene at the end, like, oh, the ghost actually trust her to actually bring the truth out and everything. When the truth is, she's basically the only one that can say George was not where he was for his alibi. And that's right. Essentially what the magic is behind all of this. I would say Justine's husband, Bram, he's really cool because not only is Bram guy that's trying to write a novel and he just grows weed and smokes it, which is a dream job of mine one day. Also, he is the voice of Dr. Venture on the Venture Brothers, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. Justine's character was another one that just completely felt like it was in a different movie and out of place. Like, her character made it seem like, oh, you're from today. Right, like you are way more sort of aware, like you're empowered, like everything about her character and what she was doing and how, like, it did not fit into what they're telling in this movie. Like, I mean, no other country.
The 80s weren't that long ago.
Yeah, I know, right? Which is weird.
The 80s were 40 years ago.
Right. So this is why I'm like surprised, because I'm looking at it, I'm like, all these other, like, literally almost every other character besides Justine. And then the Dr. Warren character, right? Other than that, everybody else is like, well, we're just going to go and just follow her. It was just so strange that she didn't seem like she sort of like fit. And like, maybe that was like sort of a thing. Like, I liked some of the performances that she was doing here, but it was weird, especially because she would like pop up in random times, somewhat spying on George. And I guess I sat there and said, did you just not tell anybody the entire time of what you were doing? I find that weird, up until the point where now I'm going to go tell on you.
They didn't have cell phones. So it was,
yeah, I know, but she already,
like, it was like you could, you know, text someone.
But she already experienced the museum thing and she didn't say anything to anybody. And that was like a day or so.
Yeah. But there wasn't anything that she could say. Like, she didn't have any hard evidence. She just overheard like a sketchy conversation. I think that her characters made sense because, like, you know, when you're out in rural areas, man, people are nosy. They're desperate for gossip. They're desperate for scene drama because there's not much that goes on. So I actually bought her being like too nosy and too confrontational with him, especially since she was like someone who seemed more empowered given her station in life and the type of life she was leading.
She's also a hell of a lawyer.
Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Bradley, what else do you got before we toss it over to Mocha?
The last thing I wanted to bring up was the use of one particular piece of music in there, which is Mozart's Lacrimosa from his Requiem in D minor. And for those who are not too familiar with this, I'll let you know what it's all about because I've seen the movie Amadeus 1,000 times because it's an amazing movie. So Mozart's Requiem is the final piece that Mozart wrote, I believe. And he wrote it to be a funeral song that he knew was kind of the end. And Lacrimosa is the movement that once he tries to put the audience into the realm of death. And so literally all the ghostly shit that happens in this movie is whatever Lacrimosa is playing.
And to me, that felt just a little bit on the nose and obvious that it's like, okay, yeah, here's a musical piece that's all about death. Let's get the deathy, spooky stuff pop out right now. And so I was like, hey, I like that y'all use that piece. It's a good piece and everything, but I think it would be either lost on audiences who are not familiar with Mozart or just plain obvious who people who know who Mozart's work is.
So I'm going to toss it over to Blewett. What you got for me?
Yeah, two quick things. So, I think the better point would have been changing the main character over to the husband and have his like slow descent to insanity be more of a focus. That being said, I think the ambiguity behind the wife character's ghosts would have been better as well. Of like, we found out way too early in this film, like very much yes, and backed up by the ghost's actions, that like the ghost was a good character. You know, like I think that this is a horror film first and foremost. And so we should have had more ambiguity on like what that ghost's intentions were going to be if Amanda Seyfried's character was going to be our main character. And so that was a big miss for me, where it's like, oh, cool, the supernatural element is actually our friend. And then we have to wait for more stuff to happen before George goes off his rails. And then the other big thing is that, so I said this in pre-production, but like this film was a half hour too long and underdeveloped. The biggest example of that is Natalie Dyer's character, I think. Natalie Dyer is not some no-name actress that you just threw in there to be the hot college girl.
Nancy Byers.
Yeah, she is legitimately a main character on, what, one of the top 10 cultural
TV shows?
Like, TV shows the last 5 years. Like, she's a known... Yeah, she's a known person, and she's not, like, there just to, like, seduce the budget leading man, you know. Like, that's it. To me, it felt like there was more there that they cut out. It just didn't make it off the cutting room floor. A lot of those scenes felt like, oh, there was more setup, specifically the one where he's like talking and then she's just like, oh, I'm done with this. Like, it felt like there was more to that scene that they just were like, oh man, we're at 2 hours and this movie is like needs to be over now. So let's just cut all this stuff to try and get it to keep it at 2 hours. And so that was a bummer. And then the same thing, like,
Blood, if you mind me asking something, when it comes to like the ghosts, so we got to see like the wives, but we only heard voices and whispers from the ghost husbands. Or do you think they're trying to pull a fast one? Like, that voice could probably have been just George talking to himself and not a ghostly influence.
So that's the problem with the movie, is I don't think there was focus. Like, I think that you either should have had bad events happen and have seen the wife so that like we as an audience, quote unquote, blame the wife for like the bad event happening. Because then at the end you could have the switch, you know, you could just pile this on at the end where like, I don't know, the switch is the wife is benevolent and she's trying to like, oh, is the husband all alone? He just poisoned your drink and, you know, you're slowly fading out because it's a sleeping pill, you know, like in the last 10 minutes, and the wife is there to try and pull her up the stairs and get her to safety. And then all of a sudden the husband goes crazy and then drives his boat to hell. Alternatively, what would be the other way around that? Alternatively, I think the better solution would have just have been made to make the husband the main character, and then show him interact with the men of that line and show them fully drive him to insanity and make the main character the bad guy, because that's cool. That's a, like, what's the Ryan Johnson phrase? Subverting expectations. When your main character is actually the crazy psycho killer, like, that is not the standard, you know, horror trope. Usually, like, I mean, I guess it did subvert the expectations of like the leading lady gets out or does kill, like dies. But I don't know.
That didn't subvert the expectations, because that's what happened. And we were expecting that to happen, and it happened.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, like there was no surprise. And they even mentioned it, of like, they even did the same thing of the use of a sleeping pill agent. And instead of suffocation, you did chop somebody up. Like, it was just weird. It was like, oh, we had a feeling this would happen. Even to your point, Blewett, like, excuse me, I think to Mocha's point, at the beginning of the film, like you said, we knew the dad and the daughter were okay. So you're already tipping your hand of something clearly happens to this woman here. What's going to happen? Like, I was not surprised at all to see her die. I was literally looking at us like, there's going to be more people that should be dead here, right?
Yeah. And even if she died, if it was effectively done of like where like something happened to her that we actually cared about, like, again, you know, her having bulimia was not just a random thing, but it felt like it because it had no connection to anything that was happening in the house, you know, or seeing the husband's descent to madness where you see him relatively sane. He sees blood in the beginning and he grabs his daughter. You're like, oh, that's a loving husband, right? And then we come to find out 2 hours later that, like, oh no, this is a man in the midst of a manic fit that we didn't know about for an hour and a half, you know? Like, I don't know. There was some cool stuff. Like I said, I liked the art aspect until just that ending was god awful.
Yeah.
Like, god awful. Not to invoke the big man who obviously was a big part of this movie, but like...
Big woman? Relax, bitch. Yeah, it was strange. The ending didn't make any sense.
No.
Like, where are you going, George? Why do you think going on a boat that you somehow killed your cousin over and you rarely paid some person $15 to go out on a boat when there's clearly a storm brewing? Why do we all think... Well, why should we believe in this film that you think that's a good idea, even if you're going crazy?
No, I think that's the point, is that he's going crazy and he's just like, I must.
Yeah, but even if somebody, quote unquote, is going crazy, which is not a thing. We don't need to get into that.
Yeah.
You're just going out on a boat that's already dangerous. Are you going to end your life? Like, there's other ways for you to end your life. Like, yeah, why would you just randomly go out on the boat?
No.
It just gets really weird and messy.
I think it was supposed to be ambiguous, like, oh, did he die? Did he not? Like everything. They were trying to be artsy about it, right? Like, they were trying to be like, oh, what was the ending about? Like, he had the upside down cross, but did he actually die? Did he escape? And because evil lives on in this world, you know? Like, I think they were trying to be cute, and it was just dumb as hell.
Yeah, I think that ending
CGI. It was god awful CGI.
I think that ending was just supposed to say that no matter whether he got away or whether he got away or whether he drowned in that lake or whatever, it didn't matter because he was going to hell. I think that was, and like that he was going to be followed by the guilt, no matter how he tried to run. I think that's what they were trying to say with it. But I also think that they did a poor job of doing so.
but like the guilt of what, right? So it's already somewhat rumored that he killed his cousin. Clearly he forwards the document to sort of lie. Yep. Then
sorry, I interrupted you, but I was just going to say, but he cares about his wife. Like, he's a psychopath, but he does care about her. He was broken about killing her. Like, I don't think that he was heartless about that. I don't think that was the case at all. I think that he's obviously a crazy person. He's obviously a psycho, and he's obviously abusive, but I don't think that means that he didn't have any feelings for her.
Yeah, but I think it's weird that the other death here with the teacher just goes, who cares? Like,
he doesn't care about anyone else. He's a psychopath. Yeah,
that's what I just think is so fucking weird. And what I thought they were going to do, especially because Floyd has some connection with the other world, is that he was going to come back, right? And be sort of some sort of ghost that's going to haunt George.
Well, he does. He changes his slideshow.
Oh my god, bro. I was like,
oh, that was hilarious.
Really? That is what, and we don't even know if it was actually him. Like, yes, it's clear, it's somewhat hinted. And I think that's the issue too. Is like, I don't need sort of concrete and definite answers. I just need you to do something that's effective. And that was not effective by any means.
Do you want to know what else is weird. Ineffective? The two women chanting. That was the stupidest crap I've ever seen in my entire, like, when they're just holding hands, they're like, we're going to get you, George. I thought that was the dumbest.
Wait, when did that happen?
Yeah, I missed that.
They had like the.
Did you watch the unrated cut?
Like the quick cuts when they just like went and they were like, it was the wife and then Amanda Seyfried's character. Like they were like holding hands like the ring.
In the white dresses.
Like, oh yeah,
that was the corniest crap I've ever seen in a horror film. Oh my god, that was awful. I was laughing out loud during those scenes.
I thought Kirk Cameron was gonna pop up for a second.
This movie. All right, who else got some thoughts? I'm good. I'm over our thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what I want to say has been touched on, but I do want to we spent a lot of time shitting on this movie, and it's absolutely deserved. But I do want to say that I feel that all the actors in this film did a really, really good job with their roles. And I feel very bad for all of them that this was the movie that they were doing that in. Like, Amanda Seyfried is an Academy Award nominated actress. She's very good at what she does. And I thought that she did a very good job with what she was given. But man, it was not good with the work that they were doing, or rather what they were working on. This movie, so I felt like, I think I would have loved this if this movie was a season of The Haunting. Like, you know how you had like The Haunting of Hill House, The Haunting of Bly Manor. I think this could have worked really well as one of those series, because then you would have had like 8 episodes, and that show plays with different tropes and different tones all the time anyway. That's part of like the fun of it. And I think that I could have pulled this off in that series or in that kind of that style of storytelling. But there were just too many tonal shifts. There were too many disparate elements that individually would have made us like good movies. Like if we had just gotten the haunted house in the Hudson River, which by the way, Warren, the Hudson River Valley is everything from Westchester to Albany. It's anything along the river. But yeah, if it was just a haunted house in the Hudson River Valley, I think it could have been executed really well. If it was just about a husband who is a psychopath and is slowly starting to descend into proper madness and no longer able to control himself, I think that could have been great. If it was a sexual thriller about this man having an illicit relationship with this horse girl and the wife finding out and that driving them to blows, like that could have been something. But they did them all together and never once tried to weave them together. We just had various strands of thread all over the place, and they called it a rug. I don't know. It was very frustrating because I feel like there was a lot of potential in here. And I bet anything the book does this way better. Like, it's based in a book. Haven't heard of the book, but I'm sure the book executes in a better way than this.
The Shining did it much better. And I'd just have to say, Amadeus was the third F. Murray Abraham reference I made tonight. He played Salieri, who killed Mozart.
Oh, wow. Holy shit, he did. That was ages ago.
Mocha, I also really love the religious art, like the Caravaggio, like those pictures are steeped in horror and steeped in religion, you know? And I think that there is, so I watched this movie from a couple months ago, like I think it was As Below, As Above, or As Above, So Below.
Mm. Yeah.
And that is a horror movie that's steeped in religion, and that film worked very well in like what it wanted to accomplish. So I think from a basis, like you could tell it an art horror film, like art, not like indie, like literally art, you know, or among, like you said, among any of the other threads that they presented, and they just couldn't pick one and stay in that lane and make an effective hour and a half long film. They just had to like somehow push it out to 2 hours and accomplish nothing.
Yeah. And like you explained yourself with your theorizing before, they could have done all these things together in so many different ways, and it could have worked out really well. It could have been about the ghosts in the house driving the husband insane, right? It could have been about, you know, people disappearing in that area because of ghosts, but the husband's suspicious and so we as the audience think it's him until the big reveal that ghosts are real. It could have been that the ghost actually just manifests at the end and help her stop the husband or keep her safe from the husband or something like that. Like, they could have done anything, and they chose not to. They chose to keep everything in its own little like cordoned off space throughout this 2 hour long film.
Also, Mocha, if you look at the icon on Netflix, it looks like a title card from a Haunting series. It's like the half woman face with like the house underneath it. Like, it totally looks like, hey, we don't want to do this in 6 years. Let's just do it now as a 2 hour movie. Like,
so apparently the book hops back and forth or through several different timelines. That I'm a little curious if the movie didn't do this. I think it was practically linear besides the first scene. But I think that also could have been an effective way to tell this story. If we are somewhat discombobulated of what timeline is what. That could have been helpful, but
yeah. Or also,
oh, good. Yeah.
No, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, imagine using the ring as a like a linchpin item, and then every single time a different woman picks that ring up, and you get to just like intersplice between all their lives.
Yeah, totally. Once we got the library scene, which again was another pointless Chekhov's nothing situation, but once she goes to the library and learns that the family in the portrait that she knew of wasn't the builders, but they were the generation before the builder or after the builders. Now we have like a multi-generational horror story that you can play with, where that exact thing that you just said is the case. The ring is the linchpin holding these spirits together or something like that. Like they made a point at the very end of the movie to show that the ring originally belonged to the original like lady of the house, but they showed it at the very end and it meant nothing because like it was just thrown in there. But if they had made this movie about uncovering the spirits that were involved with all these other generations, that could have been super interesting. And again, that's also the plot of The Haunting of Bly Manor, you know, like the second season of that haunting series. It's I just feel that, yeah, I know we constantly say that, or lately we've been saying a lot that things that are not a series could be better as a series. But I do think that in this situation, they just completely fucked up and dropped the ball when trying to put it into a single film when they clearly wanted to do something else.
And you could even expand it, like you could make the point on intergenerational domestic abuse, right? Like, isn't it there? If you are abused or like a child of an abusive relationship, you are that much more likely to be abused. And to use the supernatural as a way of, again, this is going back to the original thing with Jordan Peele, uses the supernatural to show off real world issues. Like, hey, these ghosts are like interfering, but like might not be ghosts, but demons are still real in people's psyches, you know, of like affecting how they are as adults from their childhood. And they missed it.
I felt that you could say and talk about the trauma in abusive relationships and other people, and that's what I thought Justine's character was somewhat alluding to. I understand you may not, like, everybody's not in everybody's situation, but if you can sort of read some of the signals and signs that somebody's clearly in an abusive, controlling relationship, somebody will be there to help you. Like, I find it very odd that, because everything he was trying to do, it seemed like, it didn't really seem like it when they kind of got here, but I was hoping that he would do more isolation sort of techniques to keep her away, kind of keep her sort of hidden off so that she can't talk to anybody. We can actually sort of see more of his controlling things. But even in New York, they had a bunch of friends, it seemed like. They had sort of a bunch of friends that were there, and nobody seemed to sort of question their relationship until later on, when it's somewhat unraveling, she's had a couple, I guess she had like a few sort of glasses of wine, and she's finally sort of talking to Justine about it. Then that's when they sort of mentioned sort of the empowerment. So I did find it sort of odd that it felt like, besides Justine, who I still think doesn't fit, all the women in this entire movie just seem very dumb. And yeah. It just seemed like the way that they were written, like even the men, like, just seeing a little bit more sort of just smarter, complex. Like they, like besides sort of the lines, their characters seemed a little bit more sort of fleshed out so they can have, like, clearly this is a male dominated world. But how you're writing these characters, even when you're talking about the realtor, when she's like, oh, I didn't want to share this. And I just sat there and was like, this is weird. Who is actually not even standing up, but what women are supporting women in this film, even if there's ghosts or not? That just finds somewhat strange to me. Besides the door slamming moment of it, there was nothing else that the ghost did to support Catherine. And I just found that every woman character, even Natalie Dwyer's character, even almost all the lines of all the women characters up here is like, y'all are just incomplete or just almost as if you're just shells and not even in this movie. And that's weird.
Yeah, I might be aging myself, but how the hell do you get an actress like Karen Allen and she plays this realtor that basically has the frightened anxiety energy of that lawyer that was stuck in a cat filter on Zoom?
You because it seemed like whenever someone talked to manners on that one, like that's.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like when everyone talked to her, she just immediately gets spooked by like, "Oh, what did I do?" I was like, "This is Karen Allen."
Well, especially because
a better role.
Well, like, even when we talked about it, like the movie sets up how brilliant Catherine's character is. She has a great job. All this stuff about Catherine's character, not only just being an artist, but clearly she is better and smarter at every point that George can
more
do.
More talented than George.
Right.
He's
right.
A teacher and not an artist.
Right. And everywhere. But I also find it super strange that, oh, sort of the town, like they removed all the information of what happened to this house. So I went to sort of the library. I'm like, all right, cool. Catherine, when are you actually going to ask people around the town what happened to the house? Like, everybody knows. Clearly, everybody knows what's going on. But they don't put anything in the movie that allows, in this case, I'm talking specifically about the female or women characters, to have some sort of logical thought of, oh shit, something's besides Justine. Again, like this is why I said it doesn't seem like she fits, because everything that she was doing was good to a point, right? Even when George grabbed her hands and was being like super like weird and like abusive to her, I felt like there was one too many red flags before she said, I'm gonna go tell, and then gets ran off the fucking road. This is just super, super strange.
Yeah, just a big disappointment overall.
Yeah, I think it's a bummer.
Yeah, I think that, and you know what? It had me in the first half. I really was bought in to everything that was going on in the first half of the movie, especially when the supernatural elements started to play out. We started seeing the ghosts. But as soon as it became about, I realized that it wasn't really about the ghosts and that the ghosts weren't having any sort of impact. It just completely unraveled for me. But again, I do think that the acting was great, and definitely George too. Like, I know you were saying, Warren, that he reminds you of Richard Madden, which is an insane thing to say, but for me, he was like a perfect amalgamation of Dennis from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. If Dennis was a Kennedy, that's that man right there. And I thought it was excellent. I really liked how he performed the role, even if it was within a shitty movie.
All right, so we're going to move into our MVPs. Brylan, who is your MVP? We just shot on this movie for like over an hour. So,
And this is a bad movie, so it's tough to find MVPs. But in one brief moment of shining happiness, there's a group of alpacas that look like they're having the time of their lives. So I'm going to give my MVP to those alpacas.
Wait,
I'm sure they were eating all the weed on that farm.
That was such a random moment, too. I don't want to continue to shit on this movie.
White people do weird things, and I'm not surprised they're raising alpacas in the Hudson River Valley.
Okay. I guess that's the believable. Mocha, who's the MVP?
My MVP is going to go to George. I think that he played his role perfectly, like I mentioned earlier. He was smooth, but also uncomfortable to be around, while still not appearing like a hatchet-wielding maniac until the very end when he wielded a hatchet maniacally. There we go. but yeah, even as he descended into madness, he had this like emanation of danger without necessarily over-delivering, and I feel like that's a hard line to walk. So yeah, it's going to be him for me.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think another area that I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about, but I don't want to get too into it, is this weird supporting of sort of this weird sort of white privilege that's sort of happening, white male privilege also in this sort of movie too, with a movie that's filled with like white people. I know that. Besides this, I think there's one black guy who's in there.
The guy who calls George out on
something. Now one black guy who's like, hey, what's going on here?
Cool. Trouble when he sees it.
Hey, what's going on here? Cool cats. This is not okay.
You mean discount Jeffrey Wright?
Whoa. Not even close, boy. Let's just edit that.
This entire movie looked like they wanted that one dude from Insidious. They wanted Jeffrey Wright to make a cameo. Even Amanda Seyfried looked just like she should have been Kate Moss. Who's the girl from Kate Invisible Winslet? Man and
Elizabeth Moss.
It's like even Amanda Seyfried is, you know, as big of a name she is, that should have been Elizabeth Moss. Who was the other like crazy character that just looked like someone that they just couldn't get for a film like this?
Eddie looked like poor man's Billy from Stranger Things.
This whole thing, the whole cast was just second tier people for like their A-lister equivalents.
But I do agree with Mocha on this, and this was something that is somewhat somewhat effective of when you have this family and you have this sort of person who's clearly loved by everybody. All the students love him. All this shit that nobody can say a bad thing about him. Clearly, something else is sort of happening, and it's sort of saying you need to look under the surface, look a little bit more deeper, like get out of your superficial realm. And really trying to assess what the fuck is going on, and you know, literally George and how things are happening, and how we may tend to see some abusive relationships, and a lot of people stay in these relationships on the external and the outside, it may seem entirely fine. How can this person ever do this? So I'm sort of glad they made him such a somewhat likable character throughout, until we as the audience was clearly meant to hate him. But before, he was already this shitty person this entire time. So. Blue, what you got?
Yeah, I'll give it to Rhea Seahorn, mostly because I liked her from the first two seasons of Better Call Saul. She might be phenomenal in the next couple of seasons, but I just haven't seen them. But she was great in that. I thought she really killed it for the scenes that she was in. I think she like technically was meant to be a bigger character than what we got. Like, she was the one that figured it all out. Also, the cop talking about needing a witness to place him on the scene of crime. Like, she wakes up and she's like, I don't like him because I think he ran me off the road and I have no proof of this, but I think that he ran me off the road is not the evidence you need to convict him. Like, that whole thing was shenanigans.
Hey, I didn't want to get into this, but so then let me get this straight. He ran me off the road. Okay, but you didn't die. So it could be attempted murder, but maybe
allegedly. How does she know right. that it was him?
Well, right. because she's the key witness for the boat situation.
No,
she didn't.
No, she's not a witness, but she's like a corroborator, at least. Someone that they can bring him in as a result of.
But not really.
Actually, no.
Because all they're going to say was it was raining outside and his clothes were wet.
But it wasn't raining that night. He fell into the river.
He's like, oh, I was clumsy and I fell in.
Yeah, I mean, he has nothing to say, but still, like, she having that information would be enough for the grounds for the cops to bring him in.
Yeah, the cops already brought him in. They questioned him.
People get questioned more than once during a murder investigation.
No, I know, but it's still, they don't have any actual evidence to pin.
I don't know why I'm defending this. This movie sucks.
Yeah, so, fuck, I'm like, wait, hold on.
The entire ending of that, I was just like, they still have literally no material evidence to pin anything that happened on this guy. Like, I don't see how her waking up changes a single thing.
It doesn't.
Besides the forgery letter. But even that, like, it's also weird. Do you not call your references?
Well,
a lot of jobs don't.
They didn't have a cell phone.
They didn't have to have a cell phone. There's a regular telephone, blew it. That's
available. I don't know what that is.
Everyone was doing coke.
Anyways,
that whole thing was dumb. But Rhea Seahorn, her character for the entirety of the movie, I really liked her in the party scene. The first one where she's interacting with Amanda Seyfried with like when they're drinking wine together, I thought it was really well done. She's a good actress. I wish she showed up in more things.
So let's move on to our lasting thoughts and conclusions. Brylan, what you got?
So I didn't like this movie one bit. If I paid money for it, I would definitely want that money back. But it's definitely just very just tries to capitalize too much on, I feel like it's trying to capitalize too much on like current trends in movies, and doesn't do enough to get people interested in the story they want to tell. So I mean, it's a big old meh for me. If you want a movie like this, watch The Shining. I mean, it's gonna give you a better, at least a horror film that can actually explore these type of similar ideas a lot better and bring a more cohesive story around it too.
Shining, great. Also, check out Dr. Sleep after you do that. Mocha, what do you got?
This movie, for me, did a really good job. Initially, until around like the first or second half of the third act, when it all started to fall apart. But also, like, it revealed itself to not just be falling apart, but to have never been together in the first place. Whether that was for lack of time or lack of vision, the ending itself was completely dissatisfying, uncomfortably abrupt. And with like a 2-hour runtime for a slow-paced, tension-building thriller, it's completely and utterly unacceptable for it to end that way. Do not watch this movie.
That's some strong words. Mocha basically said, go watch Endgame again. Below it, what you got?
Yeah, I mean, to echo other sentiments, this film is more frustrating because of the elements that could have gone right and made a really strong horror film, and that just to get no payoff was like miserable. I'll say for seance movies, probably I never saw The Exorcist, so I don't know how this one goes, but I know I got a lot of mean looks right there. You can't see this because you're listening to a podcast. My favorite seance scene might be from one of my favorite horror films, Drag Me to Hell. And if you haven't seen that one, that is certainly a movie you should go see instead of whatever this one was. I can't even remember the title because it's been too long.
My favorite seance scene is from Beetlejuice.
Oh, that's another good one. Yeah. Yeah.
So I will say everything that everybody's talking about here. Don't waste your time in this film. If you need to do something or maybe put it on while you're cleaning, feel free. I think you'll still get the same experience that we did, even if you watch 10, 20 minutes of the film. Everybody should check out, if we're talking about seance films, here's one very, very good horror film that still, to this day, creeps me the fuck out. It's called A Dark Song. It was on Netflix and is no longer there. Has anybody seen this here?
No.
Guys, holy shit, that movie is fucking amazing. Super small cast, but very well done. So good. So definitely go check that out. Very, very different, somewhat different of it. They definitely talk a little bit more about, I don't want to call it the supernatural if we're just talking about the other sort of worlds and beings, but something a little more interesting. And it's just beautiful how they do it in that particular sort of movie. So that's sort of a dark song, so go check that out. And with that, we have been the Down in Front Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you, everybody, for being here and listening to us blabble about this movie. The things seen and heard. Yeah. Mocha? You going to say something?
Ghosts.
Oh, okay. So, like Sam Darnold's ghosts.
Fun fact, the title of the movie comes from the name of Swedenborg's painting that they reference all the time.
Good job, isn't it?
Oh, sweet.
By the way, where can people find more of your work?
You can find me staying the hell away from the Hudson River Valley because those white people are crazy on Twitter at Bryland, B-R-I-L-U-N-D. You can also find me posting mini movie and TV and even some book reviews on Instagram at I Am Bryland. I recently put one up for the new book that's out called Ask Iwata. If you are a fan of Satoru Iwata, or he has been an influence in your life, or you just like to read a primer on good business sense, that book is fantastic. It basically collects a lot of things that are usually very private in Nintendo's world, and you get to see a little bit of an eye-opening of how he ran that company. So it's actually really good. RIP, Mr. Iwata. We miss you.
Nice. Mocha, where can people find more of your work on the interwebs?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter where I post videos of me having middle of the night freakouts about various sounds I hear in my apartment at Mocha Mike LI, as the Lord intended. Unfortunately, you cannot find me at Mocha Mike. The person who has that username is out somewhere in rural America wishing he had people to kill, but he has no one. He is alone. He's a sad man and he'll die alone just like he lived. But you can find me at Mocha Mike LI and you can find my photography work at Mocha Mike on Instagram. Check that out. Let me know what you think.
I haven't seen you post anything, so
you should open your app.
Maybe later. Shredder, what you got going for you?
Yeah, you can find us on Maya News Music or Maya News Band. And by us, I mean my band, Maya News. I feel like I've said us on this podcast, but it's not this podcast that you can find on these social media sites. It's the band that I'm in. And I'm just realizing this now, like literally 3 years after using the same byline. Also, you can find Jesse Rand standing naked in people's washrooms at igotsickofmyself.com. Casual nudity.
Hold up. So wait, hold on a second. He got sick of himself at school. Doesn't clean it off at school. Leaves the sick on himself. Drives all the way home. And then washes his clothes at home.
It makes just as much sense as the entire rest of the back half of that movie.
Next time you see Jesse, tell him that next time he's sick of himself, I'll sponge bathe him clean.
I'm just sick of myself. I haven't been sick yet.
Check out more of our work at downandfriendpodcast.com. You're going to see a video teasers at Twitter, our Fear Boners sort of section, lots of other artwork and lots of juicy details that's going to be there. We're at Twitter at _DAFP. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram, literally everywhere. Feel free to kind of check us out, downandfriendpodcast.com or DAFP. That's something that's super exciting that you can do. Thank you, everybody. We really appreciate you, and we will see you soon for our next review.
Bye. Don't trust fund kids.